You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. There's a lot going on today. And in fact, Bill McKibben's going to drop by, and Brandon Chris of one of these counties in Northern California that wants to secede. But before we get to that, I want to just very briefly let you know that OptimaTaxRelief.com are proud underwriters of the Tom Hartman Program. Facing back taxes, IRS liens, bank levies, for more information, OptimaTaxRelief.com. Not only that, many of our nonprofit stations, the radio stations carrying this program, are in fundraising drives now or around this time of year. Free Speech TV will be in the next few weeks. And I just want to encourage you. This is how these stations exist. Whether it's KPFK in Los Angeles, KBCS in Washington State, and the Seattle area is in a fund drive right now, and you know many of our other stations. If you're listening to us on a local, progressive, nonprofit station, they are kept alive, in most cases exclusively, by your contributions. So please respond to their fund drive. So, anyhow, to just dig into this, let me juxtapose two things for you here. Robert Reich wrote this brilliant piece for the Huffington Post. This was published, I think, yesterday. What is today? The 18th? It was the day before yesterday. Called The Myth of the Free Market and How to Make the Economy Work for Us. And I've been saying this for years. I mean, if you've been, you know, a regular listener or viewer of this program, you probably can recite this in your sleep. But there is no such thing as a free market. It just plain old flat out doesn't exist. And Robert Reich comes right out and says that. You know, in fact, he says not only does a free market – well, first of all, he points out this meme that the right wing wants us to believe. Right? That the free market is infinite in its wisdom. The free market solves all problems. To quote Robert Reich, our former labor secretary in the Clinton administration, the best cabinet officer of any presidency in my lifetime, but at least since I've been an adult. He says, one of the most deceptive ideas continuously sounded by the right and their fathomless think tanks and media outlets is that the free market is natural and inevitable, existing outside and beyond government. And by this view, he says, if some people aren't paid enough to live on, markets determine they're not worth enough. If others rake in billions, they must be worth it. If millions of Americans are unemployed, or their paychecks are shrinking, or they work two or three part-time jobs, no idea what they're going to make next month or next week, hey, that's too bad. That's just the way the market works. Because the free market knows best. And then Robert Reich, I mean, this guy's a real economist, right? He says, in reality, the free market is a bunch of rules about one, what can be owned and traded? The genome, slaves, nuclear materials, babies, votes? So we regulate what can be traded and owned. Two, on what terms things can be traded? Equal access to the internet, right to organize unions, corporate monopolies, how long patent protections last? Number three, under what conditions? Which drugs are legal to sell and which ones aren't? What about unsafe foods, deceptive Ponzi schemes, uninsured derivatives, dangerous workplaces? Number four, what's private and what's public? Police, roads, clean air, clean water, health care, good schools, parks and playgrounds. And number five, how to pay for what? Do we pay for things with taxes, with user's fees, with individual pricing, and so on? He says these rules don't exist in nature. They're human creations. Governments don't intrude on free markets. Governments organize and maintain them. Markets aren't free of rules. The rules are what create the market. And then he goes on to say, you know, but the rich don't want you to know this. They want you to think that there's some sort of magical thing. I mean, in a recent column for the Wall Street Journal, Cypress Semiconductor president and CEO and rich guy T.J. Rogers tried to defend capitalists and in the process showed that he really doesn't understand how markets work at all. Rogers' editorial was pretty much your standard right-wing talking point piece about how important so-called job creators are to the economy. Without rich people like him, he said, there would be no investors, no businesses, and no jobs, and therefore raising taxes on rich people like him is counterproductive because it sucks away from capital from the people who can best use it. To prove his point, Rogers used his own example. He said, and this is what he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, he said, a couple of years ago, I decided to invest in my hometown of Oshkosh, Wisconsin, by building a $1.2 million lakefront restaurant. That restaurant now permanently employs 65 people at an investment of $18,000 per job, a figure consistent with U.S. small businesses. If progressive taxation in the name of fairness had taken my extra $1.2 million and spent it on a government stimulus program, would 65 jobs have been created? End of quote. Now, other than being one of the most stupid questions I've ever seen, even a rhetorical question in the Wall Street Journal, what Rogers is saying here is that he is responsible for the jobs created by his restaurant, and that any attempt to raise taxes on wealthy individuals like him would take away the resources necessary to create jobs. And this kind of argument has become so common, so ingrained in the right-wing meme machine in the 32 years since Reagan took office, that it's easy to forget how wrong it is. I mean, contrary to what Rogers claims in this Wall Street Journal piece, business owners don't create successful businesses or the jobs that they generate. Consumers do. If he had no customers in his restaurant, he wouldn't have a restaurant. Despite what you may hear from the talking heads on Fox so-called news and CNBC, economies are driven from the ground up, from the bottom up. They're run on demand by how much consumers actually want to buy goods or services. If a business doesn't meet an existing demand in the workplace, in the marketplace, or create demand through innovation, it won't succeed. It's that simple. I know this firsthand. Back in the 80s, Louise and I started a travel agency down in Atlanta. I didn't have a lot of cash. We'd been running a home for abused kids. I was pretty broke. So I used my $15,000 line of credit from my American Express card as our startup capital. I took a risk. And what made that risk turn into a $6 million a year business within 3 years and gave our travel agency an edge over its competitors is the same thing that gave T.J. Rogers' business an edge over his competitors. We met a demand in the marketplace. Unlike other travel agencies, ours identified a niche of smaller businesses or less frequent travelers to serve. The big travel agencies like American Express only wanted the business of the big corporations, and the small travel agencies only wanted to sell cruises to rich people. There's nobody in our growing part of Atlanta who wanted the smaller business travelers. So we were ahead of the curve, and we were rewarded for it by both making a lot of money and having our business featured on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Although much of it happened after we sold that business in 1968, that little company we started on my $15,000 line of credit went on to sell over $250 million worth of travel. And then just 3 years ago, merged with a multi-billion dollar travel company. As long as our economy, unfortunately, it was long after I sold it, as long as our economy is based on some sort of free market system, businesses are going to succeed or fail based on market demand for their services. And that's why T.J. Rogers' argument that wealthy people are responsible for the jobs their businesses create is crazy. Even if the government did tax him so highly that he couldn't use his own money to finance his restaurant, he could have taken out a line of credit like the way we started our travel agency, like most small businesses do. And his restaurant still would have generated the jobs he brags about in his Wall Street Journal column. And it would have generated those jobs because it met a niche of demand in the Oshkosh, Wisconsin marketplace. The big secret that right-wingers like T.J. Rogers don't want you to know is that we don't need wealthy entrepreneurs like him to make businesses successful. Worker cooperatives can do it. Entrepreneurs can do it. People like me with a line of credit with American Express. And we started this radio show in my living room with nothing. This is how business should be done and can be done in America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And once we get the giant monopolies out of the way, if we'd only enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act, you know, starting small business right now is an all-time low because of this crazy Reaganomics. This is interesting. The country of Brazil, the president of Brazil says to President Obama, no, I'm not going to come visit you. Catch this story? Now that we know that we're being spied on, that my friends are being spied on, that my cabinet is being spied on, that I'm personally being spied on by the NSA, these are, you know, Ed Snowden's revelations, and the U.S. government is not denying them. She's saying, I think I'll pass on my trip to New York, to D.C. to hang out with President Obama. And Brazil then is saying, you know, maybe we should create our own internet. Not like, you know, North Korea or China or Iran, where basically there's a firewall around it that blocks out the rest of the world. But let's at least create our own hub and our own DNS servers. Now, here's why they're saying that and how it works. The NSA says that they can snoop on any traffic that goes through the United States. And for reasons that I can't explain, I'm not an authority on this. We've been trying to find one for the better part of the day. The big internet hub through which most South American internet traffic goes is not in South America. It's in Miami. So the NSA just sits there and goes, oh, look at that. Look at that. There's another one. You know, every email, every message that goes, you know, from Argentina to Brazil or back, goes through Miami. Now, part of that might have something to do with the fact that the internet was created by the United States. It was originally DARPANET. It was originally, you know, the Department of Defense's thing. But, you know, I think this is fascinating. Brazil is saying, nah, not going to do it. Now, back to this piece by T.J. Rogers. This has my head exploding. It's about a month old. It was in the Wall Street Journal, but it is indicative of, in fact, it's a perfect example of these guys who think that their armpits don't smell, shall we say, that their brilliance is worth the billions or hundreds of millions or tens of millions that they've made. And are not acknowledging a public infrastructure, a public education system, a court system, in most of the cases with these internet guys, copyright and trademark laws. You know, Bill Gates' welfare queen. If the copyright and trademark laws only lasted 3 years, like Thomas Jefferson suggested, Bill Gates would be a rich guy, but he wouldn't be a billionaire. And they keep saying, oh, yeah, it's the free. Well, T.J. Rogers, he opens this thing.
One of the signature themes of the Obama administration is that the American dream is under attack due to income disparity. The words divide the country into haves and have-nots, suggesting a national condition that needs to be corrected, presumably by, quote, progressive, end quote, taxation as a mechanism for income redistribution.
Yes. Actually, the group that has divided the nation into haves and have-nots are the believers in, subscribers to, acolytes of Reaganomics, people like T.J. Rogers. He says, the American dream has traditionally been one of individual success that is rewarded and admired. Well, yeah. I would argue that the American dream has actually been that if you work throughout your life, if you work hard, you put in your 40 hours a week, that, you know, you can get a couple of weeks vacation every year. You can put your kids through school. You can buy a house and own it by the time you retire and retire with a decent pension. T.J. Rogers apparently thinks the American dream is him, that you can become very, very rich by starting a company. Not so much. Most Americans will never see that American dream. To call that the American dream would be stupid. You could call that the 100th of 1% American dream. But to call that the American dream? No. He says, according to the latest 2012 IRS income tax data, the top 1% of American taxpayers earned 20% of all income and paid 36% of all taxes. You know, he forgot to use the word income before the word taxes. because they didn't pay 36% of all taxes. They paid 36% of all income taxes. That's how it's supposed to work, progressive taxation. But he's not including state taxes. He's not including sales taxes. He's not including property tax, things that the IRS doesn't capture.
My experience in Silicon Valley tells me that high and so-called progressive taxes are a major cause of the country's current economic problems, not the solution.
Well, if that's the case, TJ, why is it that during the time in America when we had a top tax rate of 91% from the mid-1930s until the 64, let's say above 74%, from the mid-1930s until the mid-80s, that was the period of the strongest economic growth in the United States and the strongest growth of the true American dream, which is to become a member of the middle class, the 99%'s American dream. See, these rich guys who I'm going to be a libertarian, and they don't understand. They don't understand basic economics. I mean, just fundamental basic economics. They don't get it.
Oh, marketplaces are magic and they exist in the ether.
No, sorry, TJ. I promise you, if it wasn't for copyright and patent laws being written the way they are to favor you, you wouldn't be as rich as you are. It's that simple. It's just, this is the way it works. And then he talks about how he's invested most of his net worth in shares of his own company. Oh, great. So you can take your income as dividends and pay a maximum 20% income tax rate. Sweet.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you're complaining about your taxes. We're all just, you know, our eyes are all so wet, TJ. Sorry to hear about it. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. I continue to be astounded that anybody would use the phrase free market. This is a phrase that came along back in 1946 with Milton Friedman, who was basically a paid shill for whatever industry would hire him. Originally, it was the real estate industry. And then the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which invented this thing called libertarianism as a, you know, to give an intellectual sounding and looking patina to the idea that government shouldn't regulate what businesses do. Just, you know, let the rich be rich and screw everybody else. I used to say libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. And I borrowed that, in fact, from Mike Dirks, who was the old program director at KPOJ. First person I ever heard say that. I thought that's brilliant. May I borrow that? And he said, sure. And in fact, I said, may I steal that? And it's so true. And it's like, when are Americans going to wake up to this? Well, I think that they are. I think that we saw the early stages of Americans waking up to this and the rejection of Larry Summers for chairman of the Fed. But anyhow, let's get your thoughts on this. Dean in Fernandina Beach, Florida. Saying that right, Dean?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
Okay, well, I was watching Bill O'Reilly last night. I try not to watch it too much, and I think you would really like this. You might want to. It was last night, about 30 minutes into the show. He was on there with, I don't know if the guy was an economist or whatever, but his name was Stoffel Matters or something like that. And
hang on just a second. I think you've got your thumb over your microphone. Say that again. His name was what?
Stoffel Matters.
Oh, yeah. Was it John Stossel?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
He was a little Weasley-looking guy.
Yeah, kind of gaunt-looking with, hair dyed really dark.
Yeah, and they were talking about that report you were talking about. the other day, 2009 to 2012, the 1% increased 31%, the rest of us. And they were doing, well, what's the reason? Mm-hmm. And Mr. Stossel, whatever his name was, said, well, in our society or something like that, the rich, basically what he says is the rich have money to invest in stocks, blah, 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 whatever. But the people that aren't the 1% don't. And Bill O'Reilly goes, yes, that's capitalism.
Well, he's right, actually.
And Bill, yeah.
I mean, that is capitalism. Right. Capitalism is not starting businesses. That's entrepreneurialism or free enterprise. Capitalism is capital. Money is called capital. And capitalism is making money with money. And capitalists are people who make money with money rather than making money doing things. So, you know, if you start a business, I've started 7 businesses in my life. I've never been a capitalist. I've never made money off money. And in fact, if I added up all my investments over the years, I'm probably at zero. I can't claim to be a smart investor. So I'm really not a capitalist. So,
Anyway, what the gist of it was, you know, they were trying, you know, they didn't say anything like it was completely justified that the only kind of capitalism was, you know, free market, free trade, Reaganomics.
Yeah.
Like that was it. There's no argument.
Yeah. So Stossel's saying the reason the rich got richer is because the stock market went up and they were in the stock market and everybody else wasn't. And you know, there's a little bit of truth to that. But you know, as Elizabeth Warren pointed out, the game is rigged. And the game is rigged for rich people like Bill O'Reilly and John Stossel, who are both multimillionaires, and the millionaire class, multimillionaire class and billionaire class that they represent so diligently and so enthusiastically. Thanks for the heads up on that, Dean. I appreciate it. And thanks for, you know how you say to service people, thank you for serving your country? Like, you know, hey, I know it was tough getting shot at. Thanks for watching Fox, I guess I should say. Norma in Montgomery, so the rest of us don't have to. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's up? Norma, you are on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When I was watching the Big Picture last night, you were talking about this Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yes.
Could you talk more about that and what the different elements of it were?
Well, here's one of the problems. We don't know. I've had two members of Congress on this program. Actually, several. Bernie Sanders has talked about this. Sherrod Brown has talked about this. Peter DeFazio has talked about this. And Alan Grayson has talked about this. All on this program. Two senators, two members of the House of Representatives. None of them can get a draft copy of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The White House is holding it in secret. It is being negotiated between a bunch of, in a room with about a little over 100 organizations represented, other than the countries themselves, and it's only the executive branches of the countries. And it's countries like, you know, the Philippines and China and Japan and who knows, I don't know. It's a bunch of countries, you know, along the Pacific Rim and us. Other than them, it's mostly transnational corporations. And it's being debated in complete privacy and quiet and secrecy. And Obama has already said that he intends to seek fast-track authority. Fast-track was a rule or a way of passing legislation that I think is unconstitutional, that was put into place in 1974 at the request of Richard Nixon, where the president could present legislation to Congress and say, take it or leave it. And if you take it, it only takes a majority vote. But there's limited debate and there's no ability to amend. It either passes or it doesn't. And this was done for trade agreements. And trade agreements, according to the Constitution, trade agreements. In fact, where is my little Constitution? I've lost it someplace. Here it is. According to the Constitution, it is Congress that has the right to regulate trade between the United States and other countries. I mean, here it is. Article 1, Section 8, Number 3. Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So, and in fact, it goes on, and I'd have to dig a little bit to find where, but it says that if Congress is negotiating treaties, treaties are in here. I'll have to look for it. Anyway, that treaties require a supermajority. They require two-thirds. And, they require two-thirds of the, so they're calling this thing a trade agreement rather than a treaty, even though a treaty is an agreement between us and another country. They're calling it a trade agreement so it can be passed by majority vote rather than two-thirds. And this is what they do with sneaky legislation that they don't want people to know about and they don't want there to be a debate on. And this is where I think this administration is going to get, you know, kicked in the teeth on this thing, or the shins, or, you know, whatever the metaphors you want to use. Apparently what it's going to do is it's going to lower our standards for food safety. It's going to lower our standards for pharmaceutical safety. It's going to make patent protections more favorable to giant corporations. It's going to it may mess with the Internet. A lot of it has nothing to do with international trade. It has to do with business standards. This is not a good thing, and we need to be mobilizing against it and getting ready, because when the Obama administration rolls this thing out, there, frankly, I think that a lot of the Tea Partiers are going to be objecting to it, too, on their constitutional grounds, because this is a violation of the Constitution. So, Norma, that's pretty much all I know about it. Everything I do know about it, I don't like. And publiccitizen.org has a spinoff called, I think, Global Trade Watch. Lori Wallach is the president of it, and they have quite a bit of information over on their website. So.
Well, I appreciate this. Well, I was trying to read what you had on the screen last night. It said something about ban Buy America policies.
Yes, it would make it illegal for any nation to have nationalistic purchasing policies.
Well, that sounds to me like an interference with free speech also, because I'm constantly telling people to find something made in America.
Yeah.
Buy America, because this is the only vote the consumer has. It doesn't matter who we elect. We don't really have a vote in what we elect, because they don't work for us. And the only vote
Thanks
we
to
have
the Supreme Court.
Is trying to use our money to buy an American product to force them to bring the companies back.
Yeah.
Because as far as I'm concerned, a company that is based overseas is no longer an American company, and they don't deserve any kind of consideration or tax breaks.
Yeah, I agree. Norma, well said. Thank you very much for the call. Joe in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Joe, minute to the break. It's yours.
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to kind of get a good laugh with you on that guy that was talking, complaining about taxes. Boo-hoo-hoo. Grown people pay taxes. Too bad for him.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of like what it is. But I wanted to talk to you about the cables, the ones that you were talking about that go through Brazil, and now they want to build their own Internet, right?
Yeah. They want to put their own hub in there and their own DNS server.
Right. They want because originally, a lot. If you look back in history, originally, a lot of the paths that modern cables take were the old telegraph cables, and a lot of them came from companies like ITT, AT&T. So they basically built all these undersea cables. Traditional, and they route the calls or to route the telegraphs to the United States from different places in the world.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. And now it's time to build some new infrastructure. I mean, we need 21st century infrastructure. That's all 20th century technology, some of it late 19th century technology. Excellent point, Joe. Thanks a lot for educating me on that. I appreciate it. 15 minutes before the hour, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the Fed decided that they're going to continue buying $85 billion worth of bonds every month. This is called quantitative easing, and the stock market's loving it. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome. Tom Hartman here with you. Here it is, Article 2 of the Constitution, which is the part that deals with the executive branch. It's talking about the power of the presidency. The president has the power to... Well, quote, he shall have the power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. Dum-de-dum-dum. So if you can't get two-thirds of the votes in the Senate, and it doesn't require the House of Representatives, just the Senate, to approve a treaty, then you don't have a treaty. So that's why they're saying, you know, well, let's make this an agreement, a trade agreement. And I think this thing may blow up on them. We may not even see it come forward, although it's hard to say. It's hard to say how this is all going to play out. Nancy in Renton, Washington. Hey, Nancy. You there?
Hi, Tom. Happy juicing day to you.
Juicing day?
Yeah, well, I juice too. I was listening to your
Oh, that was yesterday.
So.
Yeah, today I ate a veggie gluten-free roti sandwich, so I've exceeded my 500 calories for the day. So what's up?
What I was calling about today, Tom, was there was an article in the Seattle Times yesterday about the oyster beds that are dying in southern Washington, and I know you have Mr. McKibben coming up, I'm guessing,
mm-hmm.
and it talks about how the change of the ocean, it's getting really acidic,
mm-hmm.
and how it's, and this is because the oceans absorb the CO2 emissions, and that they are held down at the bottom of the ocean in the cold. But as the currents move and it stirs that up, it does what they call an upwelling.
Upwelling. Yeah.
And it pushes towards the shoreline, and the oyster beds are losing. They can't have the proper process for calcifying and growing their shells.
Right, especially the young
calcium
ones.
Carbonate shells.
The wee little ones. There's a word for them, like larva or something like that. But the little tiny ones. Can't
Correct.
Hit that particular threshold of calcification that's necessary for them to survive.
Correct, and they just stopped growing. And the particular article that was in the Seattle Times is about a family that had to move their oyster business over to Hawaii strictly because of this effect that's been coming along. And this has been really happening since 2005, according to the article here.
And what's driving the process?
Start me?
And it's just simple acidification driving the process? This doesn't have to do with El Ninos and those kind of things?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with
it. And the source of the acidification is the oceans absorbing carbon dioxide.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's what they talked about in the newspaper article, yes.
Okay, thanks for the heads up on that, Nancy. I've read articles to that effect, but I appreciate that very specific information. I didn't know that was happening there. Gene in Leoma, Tennessee. Hey, Gene.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, Tom, let me make it clear that I'm a very strong Democrat. And, Tom, I'd like to know your opinion on the possibility that if the Tea Party-type Republicans and some of the other Republicans in Congress who are afraid of the Tea Party, if they continue to try to cut social programs, and if they're successful in cutting social programs, do you think that a Huey Long-type Democrat will emerge on the scene and become the standard bearer for our Democratic Party and successfully win?
Or will Hillary Clinton start talking like Huey Long? Huey Long, for people who don't know who we're talking about, because he lived and died before I think probably either one of us were born, but Huey Long was a politician who his famous speech was Every Man's a King, and it was kind of a variation of a chicken in every pot. He wanted to basically tax the rich and pass it out to the poor and create a large middle class in the United States through really quite significant wealth redistribution. And his Every Man is a King speech, there's a little app for the iPhone you can get called Great Speeches, and it's got the whole Huey Long. It was the first time I ever read the whole thing, you know, and it's just an amazing speech. And people loved him. People absolutely loved him. And wasn't he assassinated?
Yes, sir, he was by someone on the steps of the Capitol down in Louisiana. And it was just some personal problem he had with somebody, I believe. That's history.
Yeah.
But Roosevelt, am I correct in saying history tells us that Franklin Roosevelt actually labeled Huey Long as the most dangerous man in America, and Roosevelt might not have pushed for some of the very progressive things he did had it not been for a Huey Long type candidate. So
I agree.
Actually, I wouldn't mind having a Huey Long type candidate.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you, Gene. I completely agree with you, and I think that a Huey Long type candidate could push the Democratic Party to the left and could push a candidate to, you know, to the left. We're not seeing any real significant efforts along those lines. And I think part of it is, you know, the Citizens United has made the political process so toxic, and the Reagan tax rates have made the billionaires so rich, and now they can use that money for politics. And now we've got this, what is it, McCutcheon versus FEC? What's the case coming up? Is that it? McCutcheon versus FEC? We've got this, you know, parallel case to Citizens United coming along, you know, where not only in Citizens United, they said corporations are people and money is speech, but there's still a regulation on speech from billionaires. And now you got a billionaire coming along saying, I want my money, quote, speech to be absolutely unregulated. I want to be able to own my own personal politician. And it's going to be very interesting. I'm guessing that the oligarchs of this country, the kings and queens of this country, the nine justices on our Supreme Court who rule over our constitutional democracy are going to, or excuse me, our constitutional monarchy are going to rule in favor of the billionaires. But it's going to be quite a battle. But I'm with you. I'd love to see a Huey Long candidate. The closest we've seen in our lifetimes, I think, was John Edwards. We'll be right back, Gene. Thanks.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. Glad to have you with us. In my humble opinion, one of the single most effective activists, authors, awakeners of humanity on a surprisingly broad variety of topics, but particularly on the environment in my lifetime, has been and is Bill McKibben, the environmentalist, the founder of 350.org, and he's got a couple of new projects out, and I'm so pleased and honored to have Bill McKibben back on the program with us. His new book, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist, and his new movie, Do the Math, which debuts next week. We are going to play the trailer for it during the break after Bill and I finish our conversation. I don't want it to cut into our time together. Bill McKibben, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, brother. How are you?
I am fine. It's great to have you with us. You've been on this program a lot of times over the years. In fact, even as I recall, before 350.org got rolling or got to what it is now. Tell us, first of all, about your choice, Oil and Honey or Do the Math. I want to cover both of them.
Well, let me tell you the really important thing, which is that on Saturday around the country, we're having about 215 demonstrations in all 50 states to, as we're saying, draw the line against the Keystone Pipeline. This will be the next big day of action across the country. I'm going to be in Seattle while it's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be great. People can go to 350.org and find out just where they need to be.
Great. Okay, and that's Saturday, National Day of Action. Super.
Draw the line.
So Oil and Honey, I can't say I've read it from cover to cover. I have read a fair amount of it. This is a beautiful autobiography about the subtitle tells it, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. What provoked you to write this?
Well, look, I mean, partly it's that I was spending too much time on the road and really missing home in Vermont, something you would understand having spent some time in the Green Mountain State.
Yeah, I lived there a decade. And it's a beautiful state.
It's a good place. And so I wanted to write about the amazing local things that were going on there. And the vehicle that I used was a wonderful neighbor of mine, Kirk Webster, the first big chemical-free apiarist in the country, beekeeper. He has extraordinarily healthy beehives, even in the midst of the plague against bees that's overtaking the country. And it was a good way to write about this renewed local agriculture and economy and everything else. It was really beautiful, and it was really fun to be out a lot in the bee yards and things. Mm-hmm. Of course, it also was a very good reminder that you can't deal with things just on a local level. Vermont really learned that 2 years ago this month when Hurricane Irene came roaring up the east coast of the U.S. and passed over record warm water off New York and New Jersey, and then just dropped rain of a completely unprecedented amount on Vermont before it was over. As you know, half the state had washed away, including a lot of those beautiful organic farms that people had spent the last two decades building. So it was a real reminder that why we do the work we do at places like 350.org, that we cannot solve this problem just locally. We certainly can't solve it just by changing our light bulbs. We do need to come together also on a national and a global basis to demand real structural shifts, or else we're going to live in a place with the temperature remarkably similar to hell, I fear.
Yeah. Do the Math is debuting this, it's about an hour-long video that you have put together, tell me about the company that put it together, but it features you, and it's going to debut on the 22nd on Al Jazeera. Do I have that right?
I think that's right. It's a kind of broadcast a film of this evening that we put together and took to 27 cities in 28 days or something in November and December last year around the country, that launched this campaign for the divestment of fossil fuel stock, a campaign that now has already, even in these early days, succeeded in 15 big cities, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Providence, convinced 6 or 7 colleges already to divest, and fight is underway at 380 more. Even some of our big religious denominations are divesting. The United Church of Christ did it this summer. We play defense against things like the Keystone Pipeline, but we like to play offense against the fossil fuel industry too, to put them on the back foot and knock them off balance.
Yeah. And it's a fine thing. And as I said, we'll play the trailer to this when we're finished. The Financial Times. I just pulled up the Financial Times, and this article went up just apparently about an hour ago. So presumably it'll be on the front page tomorrow. It's above the fold right now on the website. And the headline is Arctic Sea Ice Melting Faster Than Expected. And let me just read you a single sentence, which is a standalone paragraph. It's the fourth paragraph in the article. So they really front-loaded this. But it is worrying for scientists because of what was described in a recent study as an economic time bomb that could explode if the melting Arctic permafrost releases vast plumes of methane, a potent greenhouse gas, and drives significant climate change. Thoughts?
What do you know? I mean, yes, look, the Arctic is melting very fast, and that's bad news in and of itself. It's never a good sign when you take one of the 5 or 6 largest physical features on Earth and you break it. But it also comes with other vicious after effects. Not only does a blue ocean now trap a lot more heat than that white ice used to reflect, but yeah, it could liberate large quantities of methane. And if it started to, we'd have no real recourse. We don't have our hand on the methane thermostat. If we wanted to, we could still turn down the carbon in the atmosphere and keep the temperature from getting much higher, but that'll take courageous political action.
Yeah.
First test for the president, the way we'll find out if he's actually, whose side he's on this fight, will be when he makes the decision on this Keystone Pipeline.
Go ahead.
No, I just, look, it's, you know, we've been talking about it for 2 years. At first people thought there was no chance, but now there's a chance, and so the pressure's on. If he does the right thing, then he's the first world leader to have stopped a big project because of its effect on the climate. Yeah. If he does the wrong thing, then on climate, he's a fraud.
I'm curious if you saw that BBC documentary from a few years back where they deconstructed the Permian mass extinction and tied it back to a methane burp when the ocean was warmed up.
Yes.
Enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, you know what? I do my best not to scare myself unnecessarily. we've got enough problems just with the day to day. I mean, look what happened in Colorado over the weekend. There's a serious disaster caused by a changing climate that's here in front of us already, and precisely the kind of thing that should be moving us to take action fast.
Right.
This is, you know, the amount of damage it causes, the amount of heartache and angst it produces, they're almost incalculable, and we're just doing nothing at the moment.
Yeah.
So it's really, I mean, well, last year the federal government spent more money responding to Sandy and to the drought in the Midwest than they spent on education. I mean, we've really reached the point where time to do something.
Wow, that is absolutely extraordinary. If you are interested and you would like, I've got about a 10-minute cutdown of that BBC hour-long documentary.
I'll look
email
forward to seeing it. Please,
no.
Send
okay.
it to me.
I will send it to you. I'll ask Sean to get the email that you'd like it sent to. Bill McKibben, 350.org. The movie's coming out next week and on Al Jazeera. And you can learn all about it over 350.org. And the book, Oil and Honey. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks much, Tom. Take care.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bill McKibben, one of the great, not just great environmentalists, one of the great human beings of our times. A man who's really changing the course of history. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve in Chicago, Illinois, listening to WCPT. What's on your mind, Steve?
Yes, I want to address something that a previous caller had raised in terms of the conversation.
Steve, your phone is breaking up. It sounds like almost like a bad Skype call. If it's a cell phone, could you move to another part of the room, or is there anything you can do?
I called in, and it's been going on. I had to call back in, and I don't know if it's on my side or yours.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Sounds okay now, yeah.
Okay. Well, with regard to what an earlier caller raised in terms of the discussion that Bill O'Reilly and John Stossel had, and, you know, let's keep in mind that there are any number of ways that one can lie. To suggest something that is objectively false is a lie, but there are also lies of omission. And it was interesting, and then I also saw that conversation between those two last night. And, you know, the discussion, and you rightfully pointed out that, you know, that wealthy people do have the opportunity to keep their money in the market. So when you see gains in the market, they're going to disproportionately gain from that upward trend.
Right.
As opposed to average Joe, who might have a little bit of money in the market, but unlike, say, a Romney, he doesn't have to pull money out of the market in order to send his child to school.
Right.
And the problem with the discussion that was had last night, at least in part, was that no one wants to talk about just how it is that these people are not only including the fact that they're making money because they're already wealthy, but just why is the market going up? In part, it's going up because they are able to invest in companies which are able to circumvent U.S. laws with regard to minimum wage standards, workplace safety standards, by moving their money abroad and investing in companies that produce goods and sometimes services that you and I consume. So that discussion was never had among Bill O'Reilly and John Stossel yesterday. And that's, I think, the lie of omission of which I spoke. That until we begin to include that, you know, why is it that people can make money basically doing what we consider in this country to be immoral and unethical and illegal, but they can do it somewhere else because you can produce product X in Bangladesh and sell it here in the United States at a Walmart. Well, I can make a great deal of money by investing in Walmart, buying its shares. So we need to talk about that, but unfortunately that's not a discussion that they were willing to have.
Yeah, yeah. And they were not willing to have it, of course, because they're both multimillionaires. They're on a network owned by a billionaire, and its stated purpose, well, not stated, its apparent purpose is to promote the interests of the political party that pretty much exclusively represents the interests of the billionaires and the transnational corporations. So, surprise, surprise.
We had more people like the Elizabeth Warrens of the world who needed somebody to finally stand up and say to people, you know, this nonsense Horatio Alger story that you hear from the right about Americans who are wealthy because of the hard work and dedication, they were just smarter and brighter and harder working than the rest of us. Well, you know, point to me the person who was able to ascend in this society without the aid of government. I would love to find them because I have yet to find that.
Yeah, there is no such person. And you know, wealth in and of itself is not something that should be used to vilify people. George Soros will come right out and tell you, you know, he made a lot of his money manipulating currencies and he doesn't think it's a good thing. It shouldn't be legal, but it was legal. He did it and he made a lot of money and he's using some of that money to do good stuff like, you know, underwriting Demos, for example. And a lot of progressive causes. But, you know, he's really the rare one. A lot of these billionaires instead are just looking for more ways to hoard their wealth and you know, screw the middle class, which is really, really tragic. Steve, thanks for listening to WCPT. Thanks for your thoughtful comments. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS, which I believe is having a fundraising drive right now. And is it this week, Paul? Do you know? Paul? Paul's not on the phone. Okay. Beth, and Paul, you got to listen to your phone, not your radio. Beth in Inkster, Michigan. Hey, Beth, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's nice to hear from you again. I called a little while ago talking about the GMOs before you became enlightened about GMOs, all the wreckage it causes on our ecosystems and everything. I'm calling back again.
If I may respectfully point out that when I first wrote about the dangers of GMOs, it was in 1995 in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight.
Okay. I'm the president and CEO of a nonprofit called United Nations for Animals because of the fact that the United Nations is not really addressing the issues of the environment and animal protection like is what's needed. I saw on TED Talks, which is aired on Link TV, also Enviro, which is one of your programs on free speech, talked about how 40% of the carbon emissions are caused by power plants. And I have a solution. I've been trying to get a hold of Senator Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. I can't get a hold of anyone. I wish it was as easy to get a hold of President Obama as it is to get a hold of you. But if President Obama would sign an executive order ordering the owners of the power plants to build and maintain algae ponds next to the power plants, that would detour the carbon emissions into the algae ponds, we could get rid of 40% of the pollution of the world because algae eats carbon emissions, and it returns fresh oxygen to the
sky. Right, as does every other plant that engages in photosynthesis. But here's the question: when a tree forms cellulose, forms trunk material out of carbon dioxide that they absorb from the atmosphere, that becomes part of that tree for 100 years, 200 years, 300 years. When algae dies, the life cycle, the lifespan of a algae cell is months. When algae dies, it decomposes and the carbon is re-released into the atmosphere. How is that anything other than just temporary sequestration?
Well, what you can do is make a side product of the algae. I mean, people buy algae. They take vitamins.
Right, but as soon as you eat the algae, you're going to break down the carbon in it and convert it back into carbon dioxide and exhale it.
Well, you would think so, but it doesn't work that way.
Okay. All right. I'm missing something about the carbon-oxygen cycle here. I'm going to have to brush up on. Beth, thank you for the call. And it's like there's there are a lot of good solutions to this whole problem of global warming that we're facing. Beth has one. There are many others. And we need to be seriously talking about these things rather than just, Fox News.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What I meant by that is rather than just, sequestration or terrorism or hey, let's defund Obamacare again. No, let's seriously talk about climate change. Tom Hartman here with you, a place where despair is not an option. Yeah, there's some pretty grim stuff out there, but it is still not too late to do something about it. We do, however, as Bill McKibben so brilliantly demonstrates in his life and in his work, and check out 350.org for more on that, we do need to get going on this. Tom, in Holyoke, Colorado. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, you heard about the flood along Rocky Mountains?
Ha! Yeah, well, we had a news report on it yesterday. I think the reporter's not going to be back on today, but yes, we did two stories on it yesterday on the program.
Yeah, it's up to $1 billion in damage. Yeah. Well, that water is now coming out across the High Plains on the South Platte River, and it's setting records at 11 feet over flood markers.
Do you know if there's any nuclear power plants on any of those rivers?
What?
Do you know if there's any nuclear power plants on any of those rivers?
No, but there is abandoned oil well fields. And airplanes are flying over it, and there are just thousands of wells, and they're bubbling. Like, you know, you spray soap on a tire to find a nail or something.
Right.
To find the leak. They didn't require those oil companies to, you know, decommission those wells by pouring concrete or bentonite or something down in there to seal them off, and they're just leaking poison.
So they're all leaking methane.
Yes.
Incredible.
Who are we to think that we can do? Well, isn't that amazing?
That's amazing.
Can you believe
Tom, where can I find, I'm assuming if you're describing this to me, you've seen video shot from the air of these oil fields that are now bubbling through the water that's covering them as the floodwaters go down there. Is there a place where I can find that video?
Boy, it was on a local news station. I was channel surfing, and it was an airplane, and they couldn't figure out why it was. They thought it was water running into ground, and so they sent people out to check it, and it's gas coming out of the oil, abandoned oil wells.
Wow. Wow. Do you know the name of the local station? Because I'd like to track that one down.
Yeah, in Denver.
Which station was it?
Channel 4.
Channel 4. Do you know the call letters?
Maybe.
Pardon?
KTVS.
KTV, like Victor S? Okay.
Yes.
Which network is that associated with?
Do you know? Channel for CBS.
CBS. So your local CBS affiliate. Okay, I'm going to try and track that down. Scary stuff. Tom, thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
And yeah, very much. Jonica in Tenasket, Washington. Hey, Jonica, what's up?
Hi, that's me. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, the video I saw of the flood in Colorado, I saw on Democracy Now! This morning.
Mm-hmm.
Amy had Bill McKibben on, and I think this fellow had it a little wrong. They didn't mention abandoned oil wells, but they mentioned the countless hundreds and hundreds of fracking wells that are underwater there.
Oh, so it's the fracking wells that are leaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some abandoned oil wells, too.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's even worse, actually.
What I'm calling you about is I have had a question for a while about wondering if the federal government was setting aside money for disaster relief in the budget for future increased disasters because of global warming. I don't have to look anywhere to find. I'm sure they're not.
No, they're not. That would require an act of Congress, and
right.
You know, the entire Republican freshman class will tell you that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago, God's in charge, and there is no such thing as global warming.
Okay. But I have a question for you. You know a lot more about the economics of our government than I do. Where does disaster relief money come from? My suspicion is it probably gets spent and then gets borrowed. It goes into the debt, doesn't it?
Well, it's appropriated out of the federal budget. The federal budget is made up of you know, many, many trillions of dollars in tax revenues, plus money that is borrowed to make up for what we don't get because our tax rate, you know, because Reagan dropped our tax rate and threw us into debt. So, I mean, we used to have balanced budgets. The last president who actually had a balanced budget was Jimmy Carter.
Okay, but my point is, if we start spending more money on disaster relief, doesn't that increase the national debt?
Yes.
Okay, that's the point.
Yes.
And as that increases, then we have more austerity imposed upon our people.
Yes.
And more pressure on the social safety net, which
yes.
means that ultimately it's the poorest people who have to pay for this disaster relief caused by global warming.
Right, which is caused
Whereas
by the Koch brothers and the oil companies throwing their carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for free.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I wanted to check it out with you.
No, you got it. You have the line of causation perfectly identified, Jonica. Thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. Reno in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Reno, what's up? Reno?
Yeah, Tom?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah.
Tom?
Yes, Reno? Reno?
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay. Hey, you're one of the best informed guys I hear on the radio, so I thought I'd ask you this question.
Yeah.
The impact of the money on the elections is going to be disastrous.
It already
but
is.
It seems like most of that money gets spent on media.
Yes.
TV and radio.
Yeah, most of it, about 95% of it on TV, yes.
Could they ban political, paid political advertising?
They could have before the mid-1980s. The Buckley versus Vallejo decision by the Supreme Court and then the First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti decisions pretty much eliminated the possibility of that, and Citizens United closed the door altogether. So right now, the only way you could ban paid political advertising on television would be to amend the Constitution, go to movetoamend.org, start a local chapter, sign their petition, get active, get a bunch of friends together, get one of these petitions going in your community to amend the Constitution to explicitly say two very simple things. Corporations do not have rights under the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. That's reserved to human beings, number one. And number two, that speech is speech and money is money. They are not the same thing. Got it?
Yeah, I get that, but I'm not sure I understand specifically how those opinions ban that. The FCC bans things from television all the time. And then you have a wardrobe.
The Supreme Court has ruled that the most protected form of free speech is political free speech, of all the various kinds of free speech. There are some types of free speech that are not at all protected. You can't, yell fire in a crowded theater. You can't talk about bombs at the TSA line. There are some things that are not direct speech but are considered indirect speech, like art, for example, or photography. There are some varieties of it that are limited in the way that they can be used. For example, pornography, or outright banned, like child pornography. So there are all these limits on speech, but the most unlimited form of speech, according to the Supreme Court, and virtually all of these rules I just described have been defined ultimately by the Supreme Court, the monarchs in our constitutional monarchy. The most protected form of free speech is political free speech. And when there was an attempt to limit that with the McCain-Feingold law, which said that within 90 days of an election or a primary election, and in this case it was the Democratic presidential primary, you may not run advertisements that are explicitly political in nature unless you identify them as such or you are representing a political party and you confess to that, right? It's got to say at the very end, I'm John McCain and I paid for this ad or I agree with this ad. And then this group called Citizens United had this hour-long movie. It was a hit job on Hillary Clinton. They wanted to play it in theaters all over the country. Well, actually, they did play it in theaters all over the country because they wanted Obama to be the candidate because they thought that a black guy whose middle name was Muhammad, that there was absolutely no way he could ever get elected president and John McCain would win. And so they wanted to take down Hillary Clinton, who they saw as the threat. They wanted to buy television ads on television stations around the country within that 90-day window to promote people going to see the movie. And the television ads were determined by lower courts, lower than the Supreme Court. Those ads were determined to be in and of themselves sufficiently derogatory of Hillary Clinton that they constituted a political speech. They constituted an attack on Hillary Clinton, even though theoretically they were just ads promoting a movie. This got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said basically, okay, fine, they are political ads. And McCain-Feingold does ban political ads within 90 days of an election, so we're striking down that part of McCain-Feingold. So the Supreme Court struck down a law passed by the majority, a bipartisan majority in Congress, signed into law by the President of the United States, and set up a whole brand new set of rules, because, like I said, we now live in a constitutional monarchy. So that's why, in order to get around the Supreme Court, the only way you can get around the Supreme Court, short of impeachment, which ain't going to happen, is to amend the Constitution of the United States. So they can no longer say, we're finding this in the First Amendment. That's where they said they found Citizens United. So if you pass an explicit amendment that says money is not speech and corporations are not people, Then Congress can pass an even stronger version of McCain-Feingold, and the Supreme Court will no longer have a rationale to strike it down because they can no longer say, but wait a minute, Citizens United is a person, and buying ads using money was a form of speech. That's how it works, Rainer. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The history of Citizens United in, what was that, 90 seconds? I don't know, whatever it was. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour, so let's check into the Talk Radio News Service and find out what's going on in the world. Ellen Ratner is with us, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. In all probability, that photo will have been taken by Ellen herself. Hey, Ellen, how you doing?
Well, Ellen herself is going to be in South Sudan next week taking those photos, and I'll be sure and try and call you from there.
Marvelous.
The president spoke today at the Business Roundtable. He said he had never seen in the history of the United States raising of the debt being debt ceiling being used to extort a president or a governing party trying to force issues that have nothing to do with debt. And Jay Carney, the president's spokesperson, said the debt limit does not add to the debt itself.
He's right. He's right. All raising the debt ceiling does is allow the executive branch to write the checks to pay off the bills that Congress has already authorized, you know, to pay for the expenditures that Congress has already authorized.
And that's exactly right. The president also talked about immigration today. Late yesterday on Telemundo. It was actually recorded. He said he does not support freezing deportations. He said his executive order allows for stops deportation for undocumented youth who are in high school, completed high school, and on to other education, and their parents. And not their parents, but he said including their parents is not an option. He said that if we ignore the law, it's very difficult to defend it legally. However, there was also a demonstration today of undocumented immigrants in front of the White House. It was pointed out actually by our staff that the president was on major networks on Syria, but he did not go on the Hispanic networks, probably, which is why he decided to do the Telemundo thing today. Mm-hmm. Now, also, the House has decided to have a vote on Friday on a continuing regulation that defunds Obamacare. The White House is said that that bill is sort of dead on arrival. Interesting. Congress will remain in session part of next week. They're coming back on Wednesday, which probably means Wednesday night. And they'll stay through the weekend, which, of course, goes into October. But October 1st is shortly after the weekend, if necessary, to figure out what they're going to be doing with the spending bill. But, of course, the Republicans have rolled out their alternative for Obamacare. It's the Republican Study Committee. The Democratic National Committee says it's a joke. It's the same old, Tom. Republicans are saying they want to repeal Obamacare. They want to allow families to have this as an individual deduction. They want to reform malpractice laws. You know about that for about 30 years. They want to extend health care savings accounts. We've certainly heard about that from the Republicans. And they want to increase risk pools. And I found out, by the way, from a friend of mine that is running the Obamacare insurance groups in New York, that part of the reason these supposed risk pools have not worked is because my insurance premium was so high, $1,800 a month, because there were only 17,000 people in my risk pool.
Whoa. So your rates are going to drop when this thing kicks in, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So the Democrats are saying that this bill would put the Democrats back in charge. Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Some other things going on today. Ed Royce, he's the Republican from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He said that nobody in the State Department has been fired because of Benghazi. He said that the State Department has not held anybody accountable. And interesting, Patrick Kennedy, Undersecretary of State, said that four people have been relieved of their post. If that is not accountability, then what is?
Hmm. Excellent point.
Very, very good point. Let's see what else I got for you, because I've got lots and I just got to be able to read it. Okay. Today there were four military leaders. They warned against sequestration. This was in terms of our services committee. It was General Odinero from the Army, the General of the Navy, well, I guess he's not a general, but Air Force and Marine Corps. They said we would struggle to meet one major strategic operation under the current sequestration, and that 85% of the combat teams will not be ready if needed under sequestration.
Wow. That's not, of course, causing the Republicans to reconsider their, you know, John Boehner saying, I got 98% of everything I wanted, their love of sequestration.
No, it's very interesting. If you look at the politics of that, though, it is one committee that is doing this, and it's run by a Republican who's clearly not doing lockstep with the rest of his Republicans.
Interesting.
So that's sort of an interesting politics. Now, what's interesting about the Republicans' point of view on health care is I've actually, truth and whatever, I'm not in Washington today. I'm at a conference at Harvard, and it is on medical issues. And one of the things that they are saying is that 85% of research now is done by the drug companies. It used to be done by the government. But now often they are even saying that the data can be held by the drug companies. And often the first and second draft of what is going to go into a journal is controlled by the drug companies. So that we're not getting what we did 40, 50 years ago in terms of the government.
When the National Institutes of Health used to fund these things. Yes, and not only are they able to control the information to us, but perhaps even more important, they're able to make the initial decision about what they're going to do research into. So if they know that there's a multi-million dollar market for, you know, some kind of Botox new product that can be injected into people's faces to make them look younger, they will put billions of dollars into that instead of into developing a new antibiotic or some new, something that's going to cure malaria.
Like exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's the problem. And the Republican, if you look at the Republican and read between the lines in the Republican health care plan that the Republican Study Committee outlined today, Tom, and you realize they don't want government control. What they want is corporate control.
Well, that's always been the in the modern era anyway, in the last century and a half. Yeah, that's always been the position of the Republicans. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's been an interesting day. Bill McKibben came in and talked about how 350.org has this new movie, Do the Math, coming out next week on Al Jazeera. And he has a new book, kind of an autobiography, but it's also, you know, the story of how he learned to be who he is, called Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. And we've covered a lot of territory here in the program over the last couple of hours. Right now, Brandon Criss is with us. He is a Siskiyou County Board of Supervisor member, a Republican representing District 1. The website, co.siskiyou, siskiyou.ca.us. And Brandon, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Back 80 years ago, your county tried to secede from California, and then that effort got derailed by World War II. Looks like you guys are going to take another shot at it.
We are, and there's been a historical precedence for this. Back in 1992, there was a vote through California among several counties, and 27 out of 58 counties said they wanted to split the state of California. They felt it was ungovernable.
Right. I think that I have been calling for breaking up states for a long time, and I'm on the liberal end. You're on the conservative end. I think you might find some unlikely allies and maybe even able to make it a movement if you were to go a little larger on this, if I may be so presumptuous as to offer you just a suggestion. And that would be to say, you know, New York City has, what, 15 million people? That's bigger than most states. It should be its own state, and then let the rest of New York be a second state.
Sure.
Florida, southern Florida, the Miami area, has more people in it than the all but about six states. Separate that and let the rest of Florida be a separate state. Separate Texas into two states, East Texas, West Texas. One gets Dallas, one gets Houston. Separate California into three states. Let Southern California become its own state. Let Central California up to San Francisco become its own state. And let Northern California become its own state. If you were to do that, each one of those states, each one of those areas would then have two senators. You would have far more equal representation in the United States Senate of the American electorate. You would accomplish the secession that you're trying to accomplish with the northern part of California. And actually, you know, a lot of liberals would be up for that because there would be Southern California and New York City would almost certainly be liberal senators, although northern, you know, the rest of New York State would probably be a conservative senator. South Florida might be conservative, the rest of Florida. Who knows? I mean, who knows how it would play out? But it would be a more representative America. What do you think?
It definitely would be. That vote back in 1992 was for three states in California.
Mm-hmm.
So you got 27 counties here that agree with your idea. That is something we need to bring about. When California was created, President Polk said it was just too large to even consider to be a large state. And then my county, Siskiyou County, and the neighboring Modoc County, we're the size of the state of Vermont. So we do have other counties are now jumping on board. Modoc County will be voting in a couple weeks. And Redding, California, which is the largest city north of Sacramento, they put it on their agenda, too, in the next couple of weeks to vote on.
Right. But the reality is, in terms of parliamentary process, counties can vote to secede all day long. But you're going to have the state assembly and the state senate, by majority votes, support you. And then, on top of that, once that has happened, you're going to have the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, by majority vote, go along with you. What do you think the chances are?
It depends on the balancing act. If it happens in different states, Republicans will want some to counter Democrat. Democrats will want some to counter a Republican. It'd be just like in the 1850s when they were bringing about new states. It was pro-slave and anti-slave senators.
Right. The Missouri Compromise.
Yeah, the Missouri Compromise.
Yeah, that's why I'm suggesting that you guys ought to think big and try to make this a national movement and try to find alignment with or alliances with people in Florida and New York State, certainly New York City anyway.
No, you're right.
You know, in Texas, in Southern California, who would agree with this. And I don't know if there's any other states that are so big that they probably should be broken in two. I can't, you know, maybe arguably Chicago should be separated from the rest of Illinois.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would make America, I think, frankly, more governable. I think it would give more people who feel like they don't have a voice, particularly in the United States Senate, which is a very, very powerful body. And, you know, who doesn't like more senators and more representation?
That's it. Now, there used to be a time Phillips County, Colorado, presented an idea that each county have a representative in the state legislature.
Right.
And California used to do that. We voted for it five times. The whole population of California since the 1920s to the Supreme Court and Reynolds v. Sims and those court cases, the one-man, one-vote decisions.
Right.
The people of California voted for senators more or less by county. No senator could. There was 40 state senators in California. No senator could have more than three counties, and then no county could have more than one senator. So Los Angeles County had around 30 state assemblymen in the assembly, but only had one state senator, and then the rural areas were able to be a checks and balances is what you really need.
Right. And what you just described with Los Angeles County is the same thing we're seeing in the U.S. Senate with, you know, you've got Wyoming and Vermont and Oklahoma. I mean, you've got states with 600,000 people, 800,000 people, 1.5 million people who have two senators. And then you got California, which is, what, 37 million people now or something like that? What's
it
the population?
38 million people.
38 million? You know, with two senators. That's crazy.
It is. And it's hard to even get state representatives, you know, the state governor or the state senators even come up to Siskiyou County, they don't come up at all.
Right, because
it's not enough votes.
Yeah, not enough votes. Why bother? And
what's frustrating is the urban areas pass laws that make sense in urban areas,
uh-huh.
but they just don't make sense in rural California.
Oh, and I remember the one thing I was thinking that I knew I was missing a state. The other one that I would suggest adding is Washington, D.C. There's 900,000 people in Washington, D.C. We're bigger than Wyoming and Vermont. And we have no United States senators, and we have one representative who does not have the power to vote. And so give statehood to D.C., and then break up those states like I've laid out. And if you said statehood to D.C., you would instantly have, you know, 500,000 allies. I mean, this is a big deal here. Our license plates in D.C. say taxation without representation. That's how PO'd people are here.
No, I think we do need to – we can't just be thinking about our own local area. You're right. We have to be thinking nationally on this issue.
You would find a lot of us on your side. I think that you would find some real serious coalition forming going on. Of course, on the other hand, you're going to get a lot of opposition from probably your two senators who like being the only two senators. I don't know.
I know there's some argument. They say, well, if there's more than 100 senators, it'll be dysfunctional in D.C. But there was a time there's only 26 senators.
Sure.
Grown.
No, that's crazy.
Down.
I mean, you know, the largest parliament in the world is the Democratic Parliament is India's. And I think they have over 700 members, and they get things done. I mean, you know, they're starting to kick our butt economically right now. They can get some things done. So it's not the size, it's the quality. And I think that if the elected body, if the representative body actually represents the people, then they have a strong incentive to get things done.
They do. You'll have a higher voter turnout and everything.
Yeah, yeah. And so they have a much stronger incentive to be responsive to the people, to all the people, not just, you know, the large population areas, particularly as we see this kind of rural-urban divide exacerbated in the United States. So, Brandon, I was sort of half expecting to debate you because we're politically on just absolutely opposite sides of the aisle, but I'm with you.
Thank you.
You know, I wish you the best on this. Keep us up to date on how it works out, okay?
Oh, that we can do.
Okay, Brandon Chris, he's with the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors. Do you have a website for this beyond the Siskiyou.ca.us?
Yes, JeffersonState.com.
JeffersonState.com. Thank you very much. Because you want to name the new state, the state of Jefferson, right?
That's right.
In honor of Thomas. Sounds like a fine idea. Brandon Chris, thanks for dropping by, sir.
Thank you for your time.
Good talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, the new state of Jefferson. What would they name Central California? What would they name Southern California? Just in speculation. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I need to just check out. I'm going to try it one more time. Our chat room has been down today. And apparently, I know when I was over at the TV studio this morning, we discovered that there's a giant internet cable, a fiber optic cable between D.C. and Pennsylvania that had been slashed, that had been cut. And, oh, hey, the chat room's back up. I just jumped in there. How about that? Okay. So glad to see that, and greetings to everybody in our chat room, tomhartman.com. You can drop into our live chat room. It's free. Not even any ads. I mean, it's just free. It's cool. Judy in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Judy, you wanted to talk about the floods in Colorado.
Yeah, really quickly, you had asked about were there any nuclear facilities affected by the floodwaters, and you might want to check out Democracy Now! This morning. Annie was interviewing Tim Pullen, who's a reporter for KGNU,
mm-hmm.
in regard to the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons facility. It's decommissioned, but there is still plutonium present in the soil, and it's just outside Boulder.
Oh, no. Now, I suppose the good news is that plutonium is so heavy that it will not float. It could be washed away, but it probably wouldn't travel very far. I mean, it's like five times heavier than iron. So, you know, it's not like the lighter. I'm sorry?
I did attend a talk by a former Israeli scientist at the site who, when he was doing his work, it was assumed that nothing would migrate off the site due to rainwater, due to low rainfall in the area.
Right.
And
Because it's so dense.
But the summer that I heard that presentation, I think it was in the early 2000s, rainfall that year had disputed that. So the recent rainfall, of course, is much, much higher than...
Yeah, I mean, if this rainfall, if this flood can pick up a car or a house, it can probably pick up plutonium. So, yeah, excellent, excellent point. Judy, thanks for the heads up on that. I had completely forgotten about Rocky Flats. Amazing.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Wanted to talk about global climate change and the confused logic that the Republicans continually put forth with regard to this topic. Mm-hmm. George Will is one of them, is one who likes to cite this and say that back in 1973, George always gives us a history lesson, the cover of Time magazine showed that we were going into an ice age.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem with this was that story had nothing to do with it being an anthropological effect or man-made effect.
Right.
It had to do with a natural cycle, and the proposition was that we had an ice age that was due to a natural cycle, and we could have one again.
Right.
And
in the next 1,000 years.
Not in the near term, but in the more long term.
Right, in the next 1,000 years.
Yeah, and so, or even more.
Or even more, yeah, or even 10,000 years. Yes, you're right.
Okay, so that was what the story was about. But they keep saying that when they deny global climate change, they say, no, it's not. They don't deny that we're having global warming. They just say it's part of a natural cycle.
Right.
Yet they want to say that when a proposition comes up that another natural cycle could make it cooler, they say, oh, that just means that science is all confused and you can't believe anything. It's kind of like their position on intelligent design. Since there are questions of with regard to evolutionary processes, that means it's all, you can throw it all out the window. It must be intelligent design.
Right.
So they're saying that the natural process that we could have an ice age is contradictory to the fact that we have global warming. But in fact, we could have both. We could be in global warming and have they don't deny that there's increased CO2 in the atmosphere. They just say that that's not a problem.
Right.
See, their position is always we don't deny the facts. We just, it's not a problem.
Right.
But we could go into an ice age with increased CO2 in the atmosphere, and that would be really devastating to the oceans because, as you know, the
it's already devastating to the oceans. Paul,
warm, the CO2 dissolves out of the water, right, and it goes out of your soda pop, and it goes flat, correct?
Right, right.
Okay, so with regard to dissolving gases into liquids, actually, the CO2 that's in the atmosphere now, if the climate were to go into an ice age and the oceans were to become cooler, the partial pressure of CO2 would allow CO2 to dissolve more into the oceans because the water is cooler, and that would increase when CO2 dissolves into water, it becomes carbonic acid, and that would even increase the acidity of the oceans more, and we'd have basically cold soda pop, dead ocean.
Right. Right, and dead ocean means eventually you have dead land.
Yeah, exactly, because it all the food chain of it's all one system.
You can't kill half the planet, or actually 4/5 of the planet, and not have the other 1/5 of the planet be affected by it. And all you have to do is talk to any good paleoanthropologist about the previous 5 extinctions, and you get the science on that. Paul, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your wisdom with us. I appreciate it. Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Ken, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Yeah, well, I just like to talk about the technological changes that have fueled our economy through the years. One was back in 1850 with the government bringing in the railroads, and in the 1900s with the cars, and then the last one was when we switched from analog electronics to digital.
Yep.
You know, they say Reagan created 20 million jobs and then Clinton created 20 million jobs. No, switching to computers created 20 million jobs.
Yep, I agree.
We could do it again by switching to solar-derived energy, and it would pay for itself because the energy from the sun pays off all the equipment that you put up.
That's certainly the experience that, in particular, Germany and Finland are having right now. So, yeah, makes perfect sense. And this is why having the Tea Party run the United States House of Representatives is just plain old, flat-out, bat guano insane. Ken, thank you for the call. I mean, it is absolutely insane to say we should not invest in the infrastructure of our youth in education. We should not invest in our roads and bridges. We shouldn't invest in solar. God forbid. Come on, are you crazy?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
These guys need to wake up and figure out what's actually going on in the world. Of course, that would force them to defy the people who are giving them big money. So that's going to be a problem. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very catatonically ugly. The good. Howard Schultz, Starbucks CEO, appeared on CNN Tuesday afternoon and announced that he wants all customers to leave their guns at home before they enter any Starbucks location.
We do believe that guns should not be part of the Starbucks experience. And as a result of that, of making that decision, we are respectfully requesting that those customers who are carrying a gun just honor the request and not bring the gun into Starbucks.
Starbucks won't ban customers from bringing guns to their stores altogether, but Schultz's message is a good one. This is America, not Somalia, and there's absolutely no need to bring a weapon of war into a coffee shop. The bad. Tucker Carlson. Monday's shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. has reignited the debate about how we, as a country, should deal with both mental illnesses and gun violence. Carlson, a Fox News contributor and founder of the Daily Caller, thinks he has a great idea on how to raise awareness about mental illness. Check it out.
It's apparently not enough to give people with severe mental illness a pill and hope everything's fine. Alan said we need to decrease the stigma around mental illness. The opposite is true. Certain forms of mental illness, I'm not talking depression or PTSD, but paranoid schizophrenia, we need to increase the stigma.
Tucker's just completely wrong. Stigmatizing people with serious mental illness will only make the problems we have today worse. By treating mentally ill people as if they were dangerous criminals, you'll make them ashamed to get help that they need to get better. That won't help the mentally ill, and it won't help society. And the very, very ugly, Larry Klayman. The conservative pundit went off the deep end on his Monday column for the Renew America website, in a wide-ranging column that called the president the mullah-in-chief and demanded his overthrow. Klayman concluded by writing, "I therefore call upon all American patriots to converge on Washington, and when we do converge on Occupy Washington, in the millions, on a date to be announced for the week before Thanksgiving, the people may think about chanting, 'Mr. President,' to use the term loosely, 'put the Quran down, get up off your knees, and come out with your hands up.'" Not only is Klayman's piece wildly inaccurate and Islamophobic, it's also very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Amy in Boulder, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Amy, what's on your mind?
Well, there's some things the last caller didn't mention about nuclear waste. They dump a ton of nuclear waste at Valmont Buttes, which is around 55th and Valmont, which is in Boulder.
You mean
they
literally also a ton or metaphorically a ton?
No, literally, it was night after night. It was long before I was there. The Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center knows a ton about it, and there's been articles in the Boulder Weekly about it as well. But it was in the middle of the night. They just kept dumping day after day a ton of waste in Valmont Butte. And then what happened later on is, knowing this, the city bought it for like a ton of money, and then they couldn't use it because it was toxic. It was this huge scandal. Like,
wow.
I think it was in the 70s, I can't remember. It was long.
So the nuclear industry gets away one more time with having the taxpayers
pick up
the cost of their own waste disposal.
There's also, exactly. And there's also, on 2nd and Pearl, it was an old uranium mill, which is where they now have subsidized housing.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And then the last thing is this. I only heard from one person, so I haven't researched it a ton, but right by the library in Boulder, off the Boulder Creek, I met this guy who was studying water quality, and he told me, but he's the only one who did, that there was a bunch of nuclear waste there.
Wow. Incredible. Amy, thank you for the heads up on that. And I'm sure the good people. Go ahead.
there's one more thing that no one's talking about. There's insane amounts of fracking in Weld County, and they want to put more fracking in. There's fracking in Erie, and all this. No one's talking about the effects of the floods with fracking.
Yeah. In fact, I went over to the Channel 4 website during the last break looking for the video that the caller earlier talked about of, you know, the methane, the natural gas bubbling up through the floodwaters, showing that the fracking wells were leaking. But I couldn't find that video anywhere on that website. So if anybody listening to us in Colorado can easily find that, I also searched on YouTube for it, couldn't find it. If anybody can find it, send it along to us. We would love to see it. But Amy, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to AM 760. Mark in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, earlier that caller talking about climate change mentioned S. Fred Singer.
Yes.
A couple of things for you briefly is that if conservatives want to claim that the science is politicized, they're going to have to go all the way back to John Tyndall in the mid-19th century and try to figure out what political party he was a member of. Because that's when the science started. And,
who was John Tyndall, and when did it?
Well, he was a scientist who looked at the chemical composition of the atmosphere, and they knew as early as the mid-19th century that CO2 had an effect. And it was Svante Arrhenius, I'm probably mispronouncing his last name, in the late 19th century that published one of the first research papers on this.
Huh.
So. Now, all these conservatives are really Johnny-come-latelys.
Yeah.
There's a really good guy, Spencer Wirt, W-E-A-R-T, who's got a great piece under realclimate.org, under the Start Here option, and he'll give you the entire history of the research on this. Regarding S. Fred Singer, I actually was at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and argued with him in 1998 when he was claiming that year, because it was so hot, disproved global warming. Now the conservatives have switched. They take that as a baseline, move forward and say, oh, look, no global warming is occurring. Well, this ignores the scientific definition of climate, which is 30 years of averages, because you want to filter out all the weather noise. Right. So, you know, they're idiots, basically, okay?
Yeah, yeah. to put it in the vernacular of the day, yes. Thank you, Mark, for a very, very cogent analysis. Dave in Grafford, Texas. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Earlier you had a lady call in about, you got the subject on to sequestering the carbon that's captured in algae that's grown in the vicinity of coal plants.
Right.
And there's a very natural and simple way to sequester that algae forever, and that is to burn it in the coal plant. The number of joules per kilogram from the algae that you grow is almost identical. It can be burned without modifying the coal plant. And then the coal that you don't burn is the sequestration.
Because basically what you're doing is you're adding solar power to your coal-fired power plant.
Because
the coal-fired power plant produces carbon dioxide, the algae pond converts that carbon dioxide using sunlight and photosynthesis and chlorophyll, converts that into plant matter, into cellulose, and then you burn that
multiply its mass about 10 to 20 times per day.
Sure,
imagine a tree that was 1 foot tall one day and 10 feet tall the next day.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be 10 feet tall, because that would be more than a tenfold increase in mass, but I get your point.
Kind of tree it is and how it grows with respect to its...
No, I get your point. I absolutely get your point. And you know, among woody plants, hemp, industrial hemp, is the fastest growing converter of sunlight, at least that I know of sunlight into cellulotic material. And among single-celled organisms, you've got, you know, algae is really, really super efficient at this. And there we did a program on this. In fact, a friend of mine made a movie on this about a guy down in Texas who was doing commercial algae ponds to produce. They were converting it into oil, basically converting it into biodiesel. And there was this big commercial operation going on down in the neighborhood of Dallas. I think it probably went out of business, or we'd still be hearing about it. But so anyhow, what you're talking about would be, it wouldn't actually be sequestration. It would be introducing into that coal-fired power plant a certain amount of solar energy via the process of the algae capturing it. The question is the algae more efficient at converting sunlight into joules of energy via cellulose that's burned? Is it more efficient at doing that than the most efficient contemporary solar panels?
Yes.
Because the other alternative, since the whole, because the whole goal of this is to, it's not so much sequestration, it's reducing the amount of coal that's going to be burned. So if you simply populated the area around the coal-fired power plant with electric panels, you could decrease the amount of coal you burn, at least during the daytime. And so do you know the relative efficiency, given that the solar panels, it's directly sunlight into electricity, whereas with algae, it would be sunlight to algae. Algae has to go through some sort of a processing and drying process. Then it has to be burned, and then the heat from that burning has to be captured. It has to turn a turbine. I mean, there's a whole bunch of steps of inefficiency in there, aren't there?
It has to be dried with the heat from the coal plant. And it's very efficient. You don't have to do anything to the algae. It's been tested to have the same number of joules per kilogram as coal does.
So once it's processed.
You save all that coal that you didn't have to burn to make that energy, and that's how you sequester
it. Well, a lot of that coal started out as algae.
$2 billion project, which can't ever be used by the coal industry.
Right.
If they would spend that $2,000, Obama could say it as the commander-in-chief that he wanted a power plant that was powering a military base to put out bids to...
and jumpstart the technology by doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There are so many things that could be done with our military. I mean, keep in mind, the military brought us the Internet. NASA brought us a Velcro. I mean, you know, our government has generated all these innovations. There's so much that can be done. Dave, thank you for the call. Very thoughtful. Yeah. I kind of dismissed. I think it was Judy who called earlier. But you put it in a perspective that makes perfect sense.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, this is the thing. If we put a simple $100 a ton tax on all kinds of carbon fuels, then things like we were just talking about suddenly become viable. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Betty in Bellevue, Washington, listening on KBCS. You are on the air, Betty.
Hi, this is Betty in Renton, actually, but it's from the Bellevue College.
Okay.
Through the program. I wanted to talk to those deniers of global warming and tell them to go to Google and watch Chasing Ice. It's a wonderful documentary about these cameramen scientists who went up into the Arctic and they planted their cameras in front of these, you know, huge glaciers and everything.
I saw that. I thought that was the Antarctic. Wasn't it?
Oh, you're probably right.
Yeah. But I saw that. Right. I saw that video. It's like an hour-long movie, and it's like a feature film documentary, and it's such breathtaking photography.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
And when I was living in Anchorage, Alaska, we visited Portage Bay frequently, and that glacier is gone now that we went up there to see.
Oh, my.
Just for fun. Could go to picnics and things there.
Yeah.
Had a lot of pictures.
Well, you know, glacier... Glacier National Park in Montana is not going to have any glaciers pretty soon. The glaciers are pretty much gone. And now that I think about it, that documentary that you and I are talking about, that might have been Greenland, too. It was someplace that had mountains, and the Arctic doesn't have mountains. So, anyhow, back to you, Betty.
Okay. Yes. I just wanted to tell you, too, that I was on the campaign here for Obama, although I wasn't telling people who to vote for. And we were registering felons here in the state of Washington.
Which is legal in Washington, I assume.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
And it was fun. I felt good saying it. And a guy would say, no, I can't vote. And I says, I think you might be able to. And then he would just actually be able to fill out the registration form.
Yeah.
It was uplifting.
I think everybody should be able to vote. I think even people in jail should be able to vote.
Absolutely. Of course. I know. I've learned a lot from your program. I probably learned more about history listening to you this summer than I did all the 4 years of college.
Bless you, Betty.
And I was a teacher. too. Well, thank you. I would teach a lot differently.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Betty, I want to get a bunch. We got a bunch more calls here, and we've only got about 3 minutes left, so I want to move along. Thank you for the call. Mike in Delphi, Indiana. Hey, Mike.
Oh, here's a speakerphone.
Sure.
You there, Tom?
I'm here.
Okay. Hey, yeah, a really good show this afternoon.
Thank you.
So many good topics and good people calling in, and you're the same. And anyway, my thing was maybe we could come to some compromise. You know, it's petroleum or no petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
Well, petroleum is a great lubricant and it probably has some other good uses as long as you don't burn it.
Mm-hmm.
Use it for whatever market price you got until you burn it.
Yeah, they make a lot of pharmaceuticals out of petroleum. They make plastics out of petroleum. They make a lot of chemicals, you're correct, and including lubricants out of petroleum. There's lots of things that could still be done with oil. The problem is that none of those things are as high volume or high profit as using it for fuel.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. Just do not burn it.
Yeah, I'm with you. But the oil companies aren't. They're sitting on 2 trillion tons worth of carbon, and they don't want to let go of it. But, Mike, we need to keep working on it. We keep hoping for it. Thank you for the call. Steven in Salem, Ohio. Hey, Steven, what's up?
Hi, I'm trying to do this real quick. I'm talking about instead of like wind power, well, also in addition with ocean currents, there's a lot of areas. I used to scuba dive a lot, and we would drift dive, and you'd feel the power of that water.
Yep.
And in some of the areas where there was no coral, it would be great to have it, and no one would see it.
You're absolutely right. That is using the
up to land, and it would produce tons of electricity.
Yep, that is using the power of the rotation of the Earth to generate electricity, and you're absolutely right. Francis in Fair Oaks, California. Hey, Francis.
Yes, hi, Tom. So I just wanted, you had mentioned earlier about record low small business starts.
Yeah.
The one of the issues I had, with the huge corporations is you have to deal with their distributor monopolies.
Yes.
And so by the time, you've gotten rid of all of your small, I had designed and patented some pet products that I was going to try to market. And since there weren't, but a handful of small pet shops left, you're really stuck to having to go to the multinationals.
Yep.
And when I went to the multinationals, they tell you have to go to their distributor.
Right.
Their distributor then doubles the price, and when they go to the store, they double that price.
Right.
So by the time you get your product to the multinationals, that product, you're the only one who isn't making any money left on
it. Yeah.
So you can't
right.
run your business.
You're right. And it's not just, in the retail industry. I mean, it's oddly enough, in radio and television, it's the same thing. It is, right across the board. It's in commercial radio and television anyway. The vertical integration of all these industries is just, I think, a very destructive force in America. Francis, thanks for the call. Dave in Denver. Hey, Dave, we got a minute to go. It's yours.
Make it fast. The only nuclear plant in Colorado was Fort St. Vrain, which was decommissioned in 1989, and they now operate it as a natural gas-powered plant.
Oh.
There are two plants in Nebraska, Cooper and Fort Calhoun, both on the Missouri River. They would not be affected by the current flooding.
Oh, well, that's good, because those are the two that almost flooded out 2 years ago, didn't they?
I don't think Cooper did, but Fort Calhoun did.
Yeah, it was a pretty dicey thing there. Dave, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to KKZN. We will be back tomorrow. Congress is supposed to vote today. Maybe it happened while we were on the air. I didn't catch it, so I don't think it did. But to knock 4 to 6 million people off food stamps. Oh, are you hungry, children? How dare you? Go out and eat grass. The official Republican position. We'll see how that goes. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to participate. So get out there, get active, occupy something. Find the place of your greatest passion and jump into it. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.